You all know that shalom in Hebrew means hello and goodbye. Today's lecture is the shalom lecture. I say to you hello at the beginning. I'm so glad to see you once again. We've had a delightful course until now, but this is the last of the series. And so not only will I say the shalom of welcome, but this will be the shalom of farewell, in the hope that you absorb, you've been educated, I hope you've been inspired, and you take with you what you learn here. We are coming to the close of the book, and I've chosen a subject that comes at the end to elaborate upon, because I think it ought to be the focal point of contemporary Jewry. I think it makes us think about where we are today as a unique generation in a unique time. We studied, at the close of the book, the 13 principles of Maimonides. They are the basic beliefs of every Jew. We repeat them in the Ani Mamins and in the Yigdal prayer. I believe with perfect faith. And the Yigdal is a summary in shorter form of what Maimonides says a Jew must believe in. Towards the end, we speak of that faith that the Jews who went to their deaths in the Holocaust would sing. It became a song associated with the final moments of life of Jews who nonetheless, although they knew they were facing extinction, believed fervently the Viat HaMoshiach in the coming of Messiah. God promised it to us. God said it would happen someday. And Afa Pishi Yismamea, even though he tarried, we are certain that he will nonetheless come soon. That is our belief. And I would like to explain to you why that belief is so much more significant and so much more relevant for us today. The first thing I want to clarify for you is a number and the meaning of that number. You know that we are now in a year of the Hebrew calendar ...5755. I would hope that this course is studied for years beyond, and if it is 5-6 or 5-7, please pay no notice to the number that I've put down. But when we're doing this course right now, it's 5755. Are you aware of a tradition amongst our people repeated at least two times in the Talmud and countless times in Kabbalistic teachings, that this world as we know it is pre-programmed to last a fixed number of years, and that total is 6,000 in entirety? Let me clarify something in terms of our count before anyone has questions that plague them terribly with regard to a seeming conflict between science and religion. Permit me to get that out of the way before I continue with our numbering system. I know that we are taught in school that the world is millions of years old, and then we come to shul from year to year on Rosh Hashanah and say it is 5,700 in this past year, 55. How do we reconcile the two? Isn't that a huge problem? No, it isn't. I must tell you that Maimonides long ago made clear a fundamental truth that resolves this difficulty, and he didn't say it defensively. That is to say, in his time, he wasn't responding to the fact that scientists said the world is much older than you believe. He was simply stating a fact. He said, this number, as we count it, begins with Adam and Eve, that is to say, the sixth day of creation. what happened before is not included in the count. And you'll say to me, so we saved a week. The Rambam goes on to say, no. And the first days of creation, as recorded in the text clearly, are not days as we define them. Days that are determined by the relationship between the earth and the sun, for a simple reason. The sun wasn't created in the biblical text until day four. Then what about days one, two, and three? Obviously, you don't mean a day. What do you mean? A period of time. That period of time may in fact be millions or billions of years. Maimonides said that. What we were speaking about is ages, defined as days because fixed events occurred within them in evolutionary stages, and I'm not afraid to use that word evolutionary. Follow the Torah and follow the way in which things happened according to scientists, and you will see they're identical. The difference between us and them is that scientists simply speak of things happening on their own, and we say they wouldn't have happened from stage to stage unless they were produced and directed by God Himself. The stages of creation follow the same sequence as science describes in terms of evolution. Yes, before man, there were monkeys. As a matter of fact, there is a midrash that says that prior to Adam, there were ape-like men or people who had tails. Fascinating. It was a stage. We differ from scientists who believe that there is an automatic mutation and one can come to the other on its own. A monkey will never become a man unless God says, now I have completed one kind of creation. I am ready to introduce a human being who has Tzelem Elokim, who has the image of God. Let me make him in my image. The difference between science and religion is the role of the producer-director. You can't have the steps occurring on their own. They need godly involvement. But let's get back to the time factor, which is what is so crucial to us in our analysis right now. That, quote, week of creation was not a week. It was a very, very long period of time which had major events occurring in it until the sixth stage when human beings were created. We begin the count on day six. That really means that Rosh Hashanah does not commemorate the creation of the world. It commemorates the creation of mankind, Adam and Eve. Very important. And it is with regard to that date that we use the number that I have up here, 5755, as well as the number that I have below it. There are many times when in Jewish tradition there is a conflict, a machloket, a disagreement. That's the nature of our people. We understand that. But what's remarkable about this is that it is universally accepted. That is to say, all Jewish scholars are in agreement with this information that I'm giving you now. It appears in the Talmud in the following manner. Tana Debei Eliyahu. We have learnt from the house of Elijah. Isn't that an interesting introduction? Yes, from the house of Elijah. It is a tradition that goes back to our past from those who have inside information. We have learned from the house of Elijah, Sheit Alfei Shni Hava Alma. This world is destined to last 6,000 years. Do you know why that figure is used? Because six is an interesting number in terms of the creation story. The six stages, the six, quote, days. God says, I will let this world last 1,000 years per day. There's a verse which says that. Ki elef shonim yenecho kayom. 1,000 years are like a day, that is to say, the day of creation. And then what? Then a Sabbath to existence. Shabbat, we're double soul. We are more of a spiritual existence than a physical existence. That's what's going to happen in the year 6,000. Don't ask me for details. I don't know them. They're not accessible to us. They shouldn't be spoken about. But a Sabbath to history means Earth will no longer be as it is. We will live a totally different kind of life. By we, I mean our souls. It will be a spiritual existence. There is no more world after the year 6,000. Which means something extremely significant in terms of the prediction as well as the major belief that we're talking about right now concerning the coming of Messiah. Mashiach must at some point happen in human history. It would be a mistake for you to say that what I've been trying to get across to you is that Messiah will come in the year 6,000. That isn't true at all. Messiah can't come in the year 6,000 for a simple reason that in the year 6,000, he has no place to come to anymore. There is no more world. You're following that the messianic belief is one which clearly must occur within human history. Human history lasts only till the year 6,000. The age in which Messiah is to make his appearance and for which we have a messianic era must be sometime before the year 6,000, and I would dare suggest it must last a significant amount of time. Even now, I'd like to remind God that he doesn't have too much time left. Tell me, even if he were to come at this very moment, the messianic age would only last 245 years. We've been talking about this. The prophets have been predicting it and making us long for it for millennia. How long is this age? I dare say it must have some time period to it that is significant. Do you know why there has to be a messianic age? Do you know what this principle is predicated upon? Our sages clarify. There's a simple reason going back to original creation and a story in the Torah. God created Adam and Eve and placed them where? In Gan Eden. Paradise. Paradise is the way in which human beings should have lived, and then we sinned. We were cast out of paradise. Do you remember the text? Did God destroy Gan Eden? No, the text is quite clear. He placed an angel in front of it to prevent us from re-entering. If we would never come back again, God would have destroyed it. He just said temporarily, it's off limits. But there was an ideal kind of existence planned by God. God's ideal existence cannot be thwarted forever. There must be a time when we will finally reach that level whereby we are worthy to enjoy the world as God intended. There are three views of history, and I'd like to diagram them for you. The Chinese believe that history is a line going down. We started with the ancients. They knew far more than we. Progressively, civilization means a decline. The Western view has a different line. It goes up. They were primitive a long time ago. They didn't know as much as we. We have science. We have technology. We keep progressing. Progress and history are identical. And what is the Jewish view? neither this nor this, not lines, but a circle. If we started here, we started on top. We started in paradise. God said this is what ought to be. We were cast out because of our sin. We eventually are to complete the circle and come back to where we came from. The initial creation is the ideal, and the ideal cannot be thwarted forever. Gan Eden equals Mashiach. Now, if this is something that was predicted for so many years, it must be able to be fulfilled in somewhat of a time period, as I indicated, and we have very few years left to go. We do know, however, that there is a certain plan, because the next major point I would like to make for you is that history is not haphazard. History has an order, a divine order. Do you know there is a holiday which represents our declaration that God is involved in history? You know the name of the holiday, of course, it's Pesach. Pesach, because I am the Lord your God who took you out of the land of Egypt, the house of bondage. When commentators ask, why doesn't God identify himself as I am the Lord your God who created the heavens and the earth? The answer is that would simply mean there is a creator. But that doesn't prove that God is still involved or that he cares. When God took us out of Egypt, we saw that he is involved in history. He is the caring God. And if God is involved in history, and he has a plan for it ending with a messianic age, then history has an order. What is the word for order in Hebrew?
Seder.
Seder, how interesting. And what is the ritual and the service for Passover night? It is the Seder, not because there is an order to the gefilte fish and the chicken soup, but because there is a more significant order. What we are declaring is the theme of the holiday, God involved in history, follows a certain predestined order. If there were no order to history, we might never reach a messianic age. An order to history, a Seder, means God preordained that time period, and again, sometime before the year 6000. This world has a warranty, and when the warranty expires, just like all the products that we buy, they expire. This world is 6,000 years, that is a given, and Messiah is a given sometime before the year 6,000. All of that is clear. Permit me now to add something that was taught to us by the Ramban Nachmanides, 1100s, one of our great philosophers, theologians, and thinkers. The Ramban elaborated on a principle which is found in the Midrash, which is given greater clarification by the Kabbalists. Again, it is a principle that is accepted by, I dare say, all biblical commentators. Maaseh Avot Siman Labanim. Let me explain. The simple translation is, the deeds of our ancestors are a sign for the children. Simplistically, and when I was a child I was taught it in this way, it suggests that whatever our ancestors did is a sign for us. We should emulate them. If Abraham was noted for his charitableness, we should be charitable. If Isaac was prepared to offer his life for a God, we should be willing to manifest Mesirat Nefesh, and so on. All of that is true, but is not really the intent of this profound statement, which alludes to the fact that the Torah, that gives us so very much and has so many different levels on which it is to be understood, also has within it an aspect of prophecy. There are predictions in the Torah which can be understood and can be unveiled if we know how to go about looking for them. And this master principle gives us a clue to one approach about prophecy, to one way in which God long ago told us he is going to let us know something, a little bit about the Seder of human history. You already know just a touch in terms of years for human existence, but you don't know what's going to happen in those years. Let me tell you now. The lives of the three forefathers of the Jewish people, Abram, Isaac, and Jacob, Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, represent in microcosm what will happen to the Jewish people in macrocosm. Let me diagram that and explain it a little bit more fully by drawing a line which I ask you to consider as a timeline. I'll put down here Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Their combined lifetimes were several centuries. But what this principle that I'm going to share with you teaches us is that subsequently Jewish history would take over the events that appear in their lives and replicate them in much longer form. It's almost as if their lives were in quick motion, and then we're going to be doing it all over again in slow motion. If I can just make the first point to clarify what I'm saying to you, that would mean the first third of Jewish history is a replay of the life of Abraham. The second third is a replay of the life of Yitzchak, and the last third, which clearly is the age we're in because there is so little time left, is a replay of the life of Yaakov. What do I mean by a replay? We could do an entire course just on this, and you might want to take that course one day, but in the limited time we have, let me simply summarize for you parts 1 and 2, and then elaborate a little bit on part 3. There's a story about Abraham going down to Egypt because of a famine. And then the king took his wife from him. There was almost a horrible event which took place, but God intervened, threatened plagues. The king said, "Go, leave, and I will give you gifts." The replay, of course, for the lives of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob start with the children of Jacob, Bnei Yisrael, and the first third of Jewish history, replaying the life of Abraham, picks up at the point where the children of Jacob go down to Egypt because of a famine. Yes, they're there for a long time, and the Abraham story just took a few days. And then, after much suffering, Egyptians are smitten with plagues. The Jews are sent out, laden with gifts. Please go, here are presents, just get out of here. Exactly what had happened to Abraham. There are many other correspondences which we will leave for the time being to rush quickly to Isaac. Yitzchak, you know, was unique amongst the Avos. He had one major uniqueness. He never left the land of Israel. Interesting. That means he is the prototype for the time We, the Jewish people, were in the land of Israel. He had two sons, twins, who went their separate ways. In the time of the Isaac period of Jewish history, we were in Israel, but the Jewish people were split into two, the 10 tribes and the two. The 10 we never heard from again, the two, the kingdom of Judah and Benjamin. That was the Isaac age, which subsequently was followed by the period that I want to emphasize now, because within it we will find ourselves. We will even include the contemporary era. Let's be more specific. Yaakov's name means what? Akev, heel. Yaakov was always on the run. Never secure in any one place, fled from one place to another. Yaakov is the prototype of Galut Jewry, the Jews of the exile. I would say in terms of years, beginning with the destruction of the Second Temple in the year 70 of the Common Era, we enter the age of Jacob, if you will. And Yaakov remained Yaakov for a long time. His troubles with Esav, his troubles with Lavan, his troubles from place to place causing him to run and to run again, we are well familiar with, until a major moment in his life, I dare say the most significant moment of his life, the most traumatic moment of his life, I know that for a fact because it caused his name to be changed. A change of name biblically means what? A change of identity. You're a totally new person. He was Yaakov until a scene which begins with the following words. Vayivoser Yaakov levado, and Yaakov remained alone. And then we're told, Vayeovek ish imo. The Torah doesn't define who this individual was, but a man grappled with him. It was an angel, according to the commentators. Yaakov was involved in a fight. It was a fight in which he suffered a tremendous blow, a blow to his thigh. So significant that it becomes the source of a mitzvah observed to this very day. We shall not eat the gid hanasheh, because his thigh was moved, and we want to remember that story. Incredible. And at the conclusion of that battle, which it would appear he lost because he was left limping, he turns to his assailant and says, give me now a blessing. And strangely enough, the assailant does do so and calls his name Yisrael. What an amazing story. How do we understand that? If it is difficult to comprehend textually in terms of the scene as it occurred, it assumes tremendous new meaning when understood with regard to this principle I'm developing and the manner in which Nachmanides, Ramban, explains it is actually mind-boggling for this generation. Says Ramban, this clearly is a prediction of a time in Jewish history when Yaakov remained alone, when the Jewish people will be forsaken, when we will be alone, alone because nobody cares, alone because everybody will write us off. We will be attacked, and Ramban points to a midrash which is quite direct. The assailant attacks us by our thigh is a delicate way of saying in our procreative area. It is a way of indicating that Jacob will lose countless of his descendants. There will be many, many, many of his children who will be lost, who will be destroyed. It doesn't, of course, say how many. In the aftermath of that terrible blow, so significant that we choose to commemorate it, with an everlasting mitzvah? Yaakov will turn, the Jewish people will turn and say, give us a blessing. The assailant is identified as Saro Shel Esav, the representative of Esav. Says Ramban, and hear these words, to me this implies that a time will come in the aftermath of an age of horror and death and destruction where we, the Jewish people, will be left limping without millions of our children, descendants, people, that we will turn to the representatives of Esav, the representatives of the world, and we will say, after this, give us a blessing. And Ramban almost uses the words United Nations, but doesn't quite say it. He says the representatives of the Esavs of the world will turn to Jacob and proclaim, now you can be Israel. In the aftermath of the Holocaust, Medinat Yisrael was born. Where is that in the Torah? If the Torah is supposed to have anything and everything in it, where can we find it in the Torah? Why, in the predictive aspect of Torah, Maaseh Avot Siman Lebanim, where after the blow, after the horror, then comes the blessing of Israel, and from Saro Shel Esav, that happened indeed from 1945 to 1948. Do you know that that sequence finds another source, which many of us have heard but hardly understood, and I want you to be aware of the deeper meaning of a passage that is read at the Seder, interestingly enough, because I've already taught you that Seder means order. We complete the Seder with the recitation of a remarkable prayer. Chad Gadya, Chad Gadya. One kid that father bought for two zuzim. It's the end of the Seder. Now, normally we have a principle that the most important part of a prayer is its conclusion. You can say many things, but when you wrap up, you say in the Kiddush, Baruch Atah Hashem, Mekadesh HaShabbos. Blessed are you, O Lord, who sanctifies the Sabbath. You've got to summarize and put it all together. And here we are at the close of this lengthy presentation and explanation of the meaning of Passover, and we say, one kid, one kid. And I've seen a Haggadah commentary that says, we give a little nursery rhyme at the end just to entertain the children. Forgive me, that's absurd. It's got to be important, it's got to be crucial, and it's got to be really thematically accurate. It has to be a summary of everything you've been trying to say. And what is it that that prayer says? Obviously, this is a mashal, a parable, and what is it telling us? One kid that father bought for two zuzim. What do you recognize in that prayer? How about two zuzim? Who knows two? I know two. Two are the tablets. We've just said that before in the Haggadah. And who is the kid? We are the kid. Whose father? Our Father in heaven. God acquired us with the tablets. We became his people. And then you know about the cat and the dog and the stick and the fire and all of those which represent kingdoms and empires that played a role in human history. If I were to say to you in contemporary terms, the eagle and the bear, you would know what I'm talking about. The eagle is the United States and the bear is Russia. Of course, those are familiar terms. Each one of those mentioned in the Chagiga is defined by our sages as an empire that played a role on the world scene of history for a while. There is the decline and fall of the Roman Empire, there's the decline and fall of the Greek Empire, the Persians, etc., etc., etc. I won't go through the entire list other than to tell you that the prayer is reminding us that all of history has a divine Seder order. It starts with the Jewish people becoming God's people, and goes to the very end. Do you remember the ending? Do you know what the prayer is telling us is finally going to happen? The Osa HaKadosh Baruch Hu, when the Lord will come and reveal himself. There is an end of days, and the end of days is messianic. It's the way in which we complete every service with the Olenu prayer conclusion. God will be one, and his name will be one. I'm going to ask you a remarkable question. If that's the sequence of history, and the end is God's revelation to the world, the Messiah, what is the paragraph before the end? What precedes that? What is the step close to the final conclusion of the drama of human history? Do you remember which paragraph goes before that final one? The angel of death. The angel of death, representing, I believe, the time of the Holocaust, that blow to Jacob before he became Israel. And where are we now in terms of that Chag Gadol? Where do we stand historically? I would tell you that we are between the next to last paragraph and the last. We're almost at the end. Yes, we've already witnessed and endured the Malach HaMoves, the angel of death, who took 6 million, and we are now almost on the verge of seeing the fulfillment of the Osa HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Let me be a little more specific. And let me tell you something now with which I want to conclude in terms of a prophecy and a prediction found in the Zohar, the masterwork of Kabbalah. It is incredible in terms of what it said, viewed by us today. It relates to a verse in the book of Leviticus, Vayikra, in the Sedra of Bahar. I've got to put it in context for you before I write down a word on the blackboard. You know the law of the Jubilee year, the Yovel? A slave in Jewish law could only be a slave for a limited period of time. 6 years he would labor, and the seventh he goes out free. That's a Shabbat not of days, but a Shabbat of years. Everyone goes out free, but the Torah is sensitive to the fact that there might be some people who can't handle freedom. Unfortunately, true. In the aftermath of the Civil War, there were slaves who said, "We don't want to be free. Can't we stay?" What does the Torah teach us? If that's what you want, then we will let you do what you want, but you will have your ear pierced. And our sages dramatically say the reason for the piercing of the ears is because the ear that heard on Sinai, "I am the Lord your God who took you out of the land of Egypt, the house of bondage. I took you out of slavery," and chooses nonetheless to voluntarily maintain that servitude, obviously that ear, what? Didn't listen, didn't get the message. You don't want to be a slave. You don't really want to, but you're saying that? Well, we'll let you be a slave. However, no matter how mentally enslaved you may be, there comes a time when everyone must go free. I'm emphasizing this for a reason, as you'll see in a moment, as it relates to the Jewish people. But in the Jubilee year, the Torah tells us, proclaim liberty throughout the land unto all the inhabitants thereof. So beautiful is this phrase that I'm certain you know it was chosen to be on the Liberty Bell. In the year of the Yovel, the text tells us, Toshuvu ish alachuzoso v'ish el mishpachto. You shall return, every one of you shall return to your inheritance and to your birthplace. If a person was a slave, he went free. If a person had sold property that belonged to the family, he got his land back. The Jubilee year was the year of freedom and the year of return to one's land and one's birthplace. Now note something carefully. I'm going to write it on the board. When the Torah describes this return and says to the slave, "You shall return," it uses the word teshuvu, just as I have written it. If you know some Hebrew, though, you will see a problem with the word as it is written. We call that chaser, lacking, missing a letter. It should be spelled tav shin vav bet vav, to be complete. Instead, it's written without that letter, seemingly in error. But the Torah can't make mistakes. There can't be a forgotten letter. What happened to it? Said the Zohar, and I'm talking about thousands of years ago, there must be a reason, and the reason is because in Hebrew, letters are not only letters, they are also numbers. And the text here is giving us a clue as to when the Jewish people would return from their years of servitude, return to their homeland, return from years of enslavement, return from their galut mentality. Teshuvu, you shall return. Now there's an interesting thing about the way in which we write numbers for years. We leave out the millennia. We don't write the thousand. This year, 5755, is written, if you will allow me, as Tuf Shin Nun He. Tuf is 400, Shin is 300, that's 700, and 50 and 5, 755. We do not write the 5,000. That is self-explanatory. It is true that this word as a number does not make reference to which millennia. Perhaps God chose purposely to keep that open-ended, depending upon us. But it does give us a year for when, Teshuvu, you will return, and the Zohar said it clearly. Follow with me carefully. Tuf is 400, Shin is 300, that's 700. Bez is 2 and Vav is 6, that's 708. I imagine the Zohar did not know, or if he did know, he didn't choose to write, in which thousand. But it can't be after 6,000, because there will not be a 6,708. There was a 5,708, and if you will do the math or check your calendar, you will see that the year 5708 on the Hebrew calendar corresponded to 1948 on the secular calendar. Teshuvu, God said, you will return. When will you return? God wrote it, lacking a letter. We have been writing the Torah throughout the centuries, the way in which we were taught to write it, lacking that letter. Perhaps many could not have understood years ago why, but today we know. This was a prediction fulfilled in our time. It is not Messiah yet, but it is the prediction of Teshuvah when you will return. You will return in the year 708. Now we know in the year 5708. We returned to Israel, and the first stage of messianic redemption and messianic fulfillment already has taken place within our lifetimes. I once did this in a class, and I must share with you something that a student added, which I thought was absolutely brilliant. It does not appear in the Zohar, but I accept it as truth and as an addendum to everything I've said. a student, just like one of you sitting here, raised his hand and said, "Rabbi, I think I can add something." And I said, "Please be my guest." And he said, "Isn't it interesting that the letter that is missing is the letter Vav, which of course represents 6. And perhaps the reason for that is God was predicting you shall return, but the word was written chaser, lacking, because we returned lacking 6, a big 6, 6 million. We did come back, but after the Holocaust, without those 6 million. Nevertheless, Teshuvu was fulfilled. And Teshuvu is a stage, as I told you, in the redemptive process, which the prophets had told us would be followed by the return of Jerusalem, Yerushalayim. They are two separate blessings in the Shemoneh Esrei because they were meant to be two separate events. Tikah b'shofar gadol l'cheruseinu v'sa'anes l'kah b'tzchol yoseinu. Lift up the shofar and bring the exiles back from the lands of their dispersion to Israel. The return to Israel is one step. That's Yom HaTzmaut. After that, sometime after that, yes, we now know, 1948 was followed by 1967. In 1967, we came back to Jerusalem. That's a separate bracha in the Shemoneh Esrei. V'lushalayim ircha barachamim tashuv. I make the following suggestion. The reason they didn't happen simultaneously, that is to say, Israel and Jerusalem at the same time, is because Jerusalem is so significant that it demanded appreciation on its own. And if they both would have happened simultaneously, we would have viewed them as one. They needed to be recognized independently as separate miracles, as different stages. What happens when you live to see events of this nature? Well, we're supposed to expect the end of that set. It's a trilogy. Return to Israel, return to Jerusalem, and then Messiah. But there is an obligation upon us that goes hand in hand with these predictions. And I dare say it is implicit in the word Teshuvu as well. God says you will return, but if you want the complete blessing, then I ask of you, Teshuvu, return. Return to God to enable the return of the Jewish people to Israel as predicted by the prophets in terms of a spiritual vision to become complete. We have a role to play in this process as well. I think the symbolism is something that we do on Pesach night. Isn't it interesting that although the prediction is that Elijah will come to announce the Messiah, we've got to open the door for him. Don't you think Elijah would be capable of opening the door himself? What is the deeper meaning of opening the door for Elijah? I believe what it says to us is, he will come, but there is a role that we must play in addition. We must open the door, so to speak, for his arrival. We must allow him to come by finally recognizing our obligations to be the kinds of Jews that we should be. By being sensitive to the miraculous in history. By recognizing the times that we live in, Elie Wiesel put it magnificently, we are the most cursed of all generations, but we are also the most blessed of all generations. We are the generation of Job, yes, the Holocaust, but we're also the generation of Jerusalem. We have endured the horrors, but we have seen the miracles. And a generation such as ours, standing on the eve of ultimate redemption, of Geula Shlema, of the messianic vision appearing in our times, should certainly be the one to grasp most of all how important it is for us to reawaken our spiritual essence and our identity, to understand Judaism. And understanding Judaism means not simply to make a faith commitment, but to make a commitment of deed as well as a commitment of creed. To believe in God and therefore to say, with my belief, I want to act in a different manner. I want to be everything that God wants me to be. I want to do what God imposed upon us at Sinai, because God didn't want it for his sake. He wanted it for our sake. God gave us a gift. It was a gift of the Torah. I hope that in accepting and understanding God's gift to us, we will be enabled to live a better life, a happier life, and most important of all, a holier life. I thank you all for sharing in this wonderful adventure and experiment in teaching Judaism. Let us collectively pray for ourselves and for all of our listeners that studying about our faith will enable us to see the blessings that will be given by the Almighty for our adherence to his law and to his Torah. Amen. Let's all say Amen.